Hello, and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. Grace Mallon, the Kinder Junior Research Fellow in Atlantic History and Fellow of University College, Oxford, is our guest for this episode. We'll be discussing how federalism worked in practice during the early Republic and Grace's contribution to an emerging literature which focuses on the role of the states and not just the federal government in policy negotiation and implementation. We're grateful that Jasmine Bath has been able to join for the conversation. Jazz is a doctoral candidate and the Badger Scholar in American History at Clare College, University of Cambridge. Her research looks at poor single mothers in antebellum New York City. She is supervised by Dr. Nicholas Guyot, and from September 2023 will be taking up a year-long pre-doctoral fellowship at Princeton University. Thanks for tuning in, and I'm your host, Hugh Wood, a PhD candidate at Sydney Sussex College. So, hello and welcome back to the Cambridge American History Seminar podcast. It is blue today in Cambridge, very warm. We are joined by Grace Mallon and Jazz Bath. So, Grace is going to be talking about her paper, Federalism for Beginners, Intergovernmental Relations and Interdependent Sovereignty after 1789. So, Grace, thanks for joining us today. And if you just want to explain to people that haven't read the paper what it's about, where we are in the world, and what's the kind of critical intervention that you're making.
Okay, a sort of easy task there. Thank you, Hugh. Thank you, Jazz. I'm very excited to be here in Cambridge for this seminar. And where we are in the world in my paper is we're in the United States at the beginning of the national government. What do I mean by the national government? Well, obviously, the United States tried to set up a government in 1770, sort of 4 through 6, and then it kind of succeeded in setting up a government for the Union in about 1781 with the Articles of Confederation. But in 1787, as all of us who study US history will know, it created a national what was described by some people as a national government through the creation of the US Constitution. And the US Constitution was ratified by conventions in the different states, and then it went into effect. So Congress assembled for the first time under the Constitution, the president was elected and inaugurated in 1789. And that is sort of where we are in this paper, 1789 and what comes afterwards. Why is it interesting to think about what comes after 1789? So lots of people have written about this, as we know. Lots of people have written about how the US government was set up, you know, Alexander Hamilton designing a taxation system, you know, the creation of the Treasury Department, the War Department, the State Department to look at foreign affairs and domestic affairs, George Washington and his role in interpreting the Constitution. But what I'm really interested in this paper and in my broader sort of book project that this paper is sort of related to, is state government. One of the peculiarities of the United States, as we know, is its system of dual federalism, where there is supposedly dual sovereignty, divided sovereignty between the federal government and the state governments. And what I'm interested in is how do you actually do government in a divided sovereignty? So what I'm sort of getting at in broad strokes in this paper is that a lot of people have thought about like the theory of dual federalism and, you know, how James Madison thinks it should work or how Alexander Hamilton thinks it should work. And I'm trying to say, how did it actually work? What did it actually mean to learn to do federalism? Because this is sort of the first large federal republic in ever. And so I'm looking at state governments particularly and how they navigated a transition to a new kind of government in which the US Constitution gave the federal government a bunch of new powers, and the states had to sort of figure out how to fit themselves into this new system. And how I'm kind of asking, how did their way of doing government, how did their laws change as the federal government started to sort of get moving? And what were the, obviously, what were the conflicts that arose, which we're all quite familiar with, sort of the idea of conflict in the federal system, but also in what ways did the state and federal government support each other and coordinate with each other to allow this government to actually work in practice? Does that about cover it?
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Sounds pretty good to me.
Okay.
Yeah, so I have the next question, and I don't know about you, but whenever I go to tell my parents or my friends about this, about studying American history, they're like, why America? And I can imagine you probably get the same question. So we just wanted to ask you a little bit about why the US federal state? What got you there? Why are you not studying, say, British state building or the fiscal military state in general? What is about this time period and this geography that's made you end up here and been studying it for so many years now?
Absolutely. That's a great question. I did actually start out sort of as a historian of modern German culture after the 19th, so when I was an undergraduate. What got me into this, I had a really great teacher in undergrad, which I think is often the case, and we did a paper called 16, I think it was Britain's North American Colonies 1600 to 1812, and I kind of was fascinated by this very rich, it varied world of the Atlantic in that period. And then what really got me into this was after I finished my undergrad, I was a research assistant for this thing called the Quill Project at Oxford, which is sort of constitutionalism, digital humanities project. And I was reading for that job, I read the records of the Federal Convention. So, you know, what happened in the summer of 1787 in the words of the people who were there. That was how I sort of ended up being fascinated by US constitutionalism and US government. And I do try to think more comparatively about it, which maybe we can get onto or in the seminar itself. This is a particularly kind of unique, interesting moment for the creation of this massive federal republic a new opportunity to kind of think about how to do government, which I think is what draws a lot of people to the history of American governance.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for that. So when we talk about the US state, a lot of those discussions are about the states and American government's strengths and comparative weaknesses and so on, as you're well aware, William Novak, Gary Gerstle, etc. So what is it that your work suggests and gives to that debate kind of specifically? What do you want to say?
Yeah, so I think there's been this interesting kind of back and forth. Obviously, I'm going to talk in very broad strokes here, but there's been an interesting back and forth. So obviously, the myth that Americans tell themselves, particularly in sort of conservative spheres, is that Americans don't like the state. We all know this. And so in the sort of later part of the 20th century, I'm going to stipulate without being able to identify precise dates, there was sort of a movement to bring the state back in, wasn't there, in American historiography. And I'm very supportive of the idea politically that the American state is important and doesn't need to be small. But I think historically speaking, I'm ready to push back a little bit on some of the historiography that's been produced from that bringing the state back in movement. So I'm kind of trying to say, yes, the federal government could do stuff, but it was very contingent on the support of lots of other kinds of organizations, which obviously other people have said, but I'm particularly gesturing to the role of the states and the importance of their sort of consent, essentially, to the operation of the federal government within the United States.
Thank you for that. And moving on from big picture ideas to one of the small case studies that you talk about, I was particularly intrigued when you were talking about Massachusetts and the dual office holding. And it got me thinking about corruption, particularly because, you know, it's one of the big ideas that they speak about in the Constitutional Convention and one of the reasons why I don't like Britain too much. And I was wondering how much of this aversion to dual office holding was about avoiding corruption, and whether Massachusetts in particular had a particular idea about that, and whether you think actually the back and forth between states and this, like, if the state does something for me, we can do something for the federal government, was part and parcel of federal negotiations at the time, or was this actually them trying to understand how do you run a republic, this federal republic, when you're trying to also incorporate anti-corruption principles into that as well?
I think that's really, really important. And this was something that I'm really glad you picked up on that, because I've always wondered, oh, is this bit a little bit boring, essentially, because it's about this sort of quite dry thing where I'm kind of talking in that bit of the paper about how different states, some states, a smaller number than you'd expect, changed their own constitutions when the US Constitution came into effect. And Massachusetts wasn't one of them. So it decided not to change its own constitution. Essentially, its constitutional order didn't really acknowledge that the federal government existed. And one of the problems that obviously happened at this point was that the federal government is created, as Jazz sort of gesturing to, there are a lot of financial incentives for people to get involved in federal governance, because, you know, there are patronage jobs, essentially, as we're all familiar with. You've seen things like Steven Spielberg's Lincoln, that, you know, that there's that opportunity to sort of for the federal government to hand out influence and hand out money through different kinds of positions. And Massachusetts doesn't basically, so Pennsylvania and South Carolina, among others, decide that they're not going to allow, they're explicitly not going to allow people who are state officials to hold federal office as well. But Massachusetts doesn't, and they have a little bit of a crisis about it. To what extent is that all to do with corruption? I think absolutely. I think the idea of not allowing people to have because basically what they're saying is, if we think about it, the federal government is in Philadelphia. The Massachusetts state government is in Boston. That's a heck of a long way, actually, in the 1790s. Are you really going to be able to do both? Probably not. So you're going to be taking cash to do both without actually doing it. And so I think the idea of transparency and oversight is definitely playing into this. I hope that begins to get your questions.
Mm. So in the same, well, a similar vein, I guess, politicians at the time were at pains not to appear partisan for fear that it might also resemble corruption on the kind of old world. So how does the party politics of this period, or what we might now might see as kind of party politics, how did that interact and affect these negotiations positively or negatively, and the relationships between federal and state actors? And how did those kind of conflicts between federal and state actors potentially conceal party political conflicts?
That's a really great question, and one I've been sort of grappling with throughout the process of writing this from the dissertation onwards. I think I'm not that interested in party politics myself. Like, it doesn't like grab me in the way that it sometimes grabs people. But I sort of started out from this fairly technical look at, you know, negotiations over, like, you know, should the federal or the state government do X? And it's often quite boring, small scale things. And in those cases, I tend to think you can have a good faith disagreement about what the Constitution is allowing the state or the federal governments to do. And it doesn't necessarily have to do with party. But very crucially, some of these intergovernmental conflicts are definitely about partisanship. So things like the Hartford Convention. So we'll all be familiar with the War of 1812, the strong risk in that moment when James Madison is going to go to war with Great Britain. And there's a risk that the New England states are going to secede because they are this haven of the Federalist Party, which is now locked out of national government forever. But it's in New England. And the New Englanders are essentially seen as using this conflict as an opportunity to get back at the federal administration and refusing to cooperate with them. On the other hand, in places like the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, which is another classic example of kind of intergovernmental conflict, where Virginia and Kentucky are protesting, obviously, the Alien and Sedition Acts, which were passed by John Adams' Federalist government, I think people have now argued that maybe there was a bit of a good faith disagreement there as well. So, you know, maybe these are contrary to the First Amendment. Maybe we shouldn't be locking up editors for printing things that are critical of the federal government. And so there's more of a sense there. So, I mean, essentially that was a fudge. Yes and no to the importance of partisanship.
I was particularly struck by the individual states using the federal government to kind of get what they wanted. And I'm thinking particularly when you talk about the Lighthouse Acts and how they utilise federal government resources for their own gain. And I'm wondering, how did other states react when certain states were getting certain things but others weren't? Was there disagreements there? How did that benefit? But did they use that in the long run to perhaps get what they wanted?
I'm really interested in this question. It's not something I address head on in this paper or in my dissertation as it stands, but I'm really interested in not only the interactions between the state and federal governments, but the extent to which the states copy each other, which is exactly, which now we'd refer to as templating of laws, for example, is something that's really common. So state legislatures pass the same laws as they've seen being passed somewhere else, or organizations produce sort of template legislation, which they send out to all the states, which they then pass. One of the interesting things about the Lighthouse Act, so there's this great article, it's a law review article about the Lighthouse Act, very nerdy, but it gets into the fact that so many states participated in this throughout the 1790s. And one of the things that they did in their negotiations over Lighthouse sessions is they included something called a most favored nation clause. So they basically said, if the federal government should pay any one of the states X amount for their lighthouse land, we demand that we get the same payment. And so, you know, there is a sense of kind of competition, or a sense of we all should be treated equally by the federal government.
Mm. So I kind of want to talk a bit about the structure and the methods of the paper and their relationship to the conclusions it makes. So the paper kind of wants to highlight various continuities that were shared amongst the different relationships each state had with the federal government. So, and it kind of gives some fairly general observations that relations were typified by negotiation, back and forth, and that power, the spheres of power, you say, were kind of defined murkily or were ill-defined. It just wasn't quite clear to anybody what was going on, and they were kind of muddling through it. So were there any specific states or arenas or particular issues that go kind of against these general observations? Is there anywhere that they're harder to see, or that things were much clearer?
Absolutely. No, that's a really good question. I think something that I haven't really addressed here all that much, but did is a chapter of my dissertation, which I think I'm quite excited about, is to do with what was called at the time Indian Affairs, the policy area relating to relations between whites and Native Americans. And essentially, as some of you may know, when the federal government sort of was created, when the Constitution came into effect, a lot of historians have recognized one of the main key intentions of the framers of the Constitution was to give more power over Indian affairs to the federal government as opposed to the states, for a number of reasons: to prevent war on the frontier between Americans and Native Americans, to prevent war between Americans and other empires on the continent of North America. And what I found in my Indian Affairs chapter is a lot of conflict. So I'm sort of pushing this line of cooperation between the state and federal governments. But I found a lot of conflict, and the states basically saying, no, we don't really respect your authority here. We're actually going to push back pretty hard, and you can't do anything about it because you don't have very much power in these sort of far-flung regions. That said, what I'm kind of interested in there is the fact that the federal government, in most cases, wasn't really able to do anything. And so they sort of had to say, okay, you know, we're not going to cause a ruckus about this. And I think that's part of negotiation in a way. Maybe I'm defining negotiation very broadly. That something that did surprise me, though, is obviously slavery is generally, in the 19th century, this massive, massive cause of intergovernmental conflict. But in the period that I'm looking at, it's really not. In fact, the federal government is really captured by state interests, is one of the things that I'm arguing.
That's really interesting. Like many people, I am a big fan of the work of Jan Freeman, particularly Affairs of Honour. And like this paper made me think about this, of that book a lot, and how she talks about the importance of interpersonal relationships in governmental negotiations, and how that has an impact on legislative outcomes. So I'm wondering, how do you reconcile those personal relationships defined by thoughts, feelings, manners and emotions with political ones? And does the former play into the latter in the story that you're trying to tell about state formations?
Absolutely. I think this is something that I saw a few times, and obviously, as you sort of see, it's a bit of a sweeping project, but I was able to sort of look at some of this correspondence between state and federal officials particularly, and see some of those personal relationships at work. So one of my favourite stories, this paper begins with Henry Lee, who was the governor of Virginia in the early 1790s, and he was actually quite close with Alexander Hamilton. I think they'd served together. And in some of their correspondence, it's quite an interesting mix of like the personal and the political. So Henry Lee was a Federalist, like Hamilton, but he really disagreed with him about certain things, particularly the federal assumption of state debts. He really thought that was a bad idea. Hamilton was going to, you know, come out with a bad look. And that's what he said to Hamilton. He basically said, please repeal the Funding Act. Your political reputation is going to suffer from this. So I care for you as a person, and I think you need to watch out more for your own reputation. But at the same time, as they're talking about these kinds of things, you know, they're talking about their love lives, they're talking about buying horses and things like that. So I thought that was quite interesting. Another interesting interpersonal relationship is between the governor of New York, George Clinton, and George Washington. And they were kind of politically misaligned. So Clinton was an anti-federalist. But it's very clear from their correspondence they have a lot of respect for each other. And I always think that Washington's personal gravitas, his personal, you know, really allowed him to overcome a lot of potential sort of partisan disagreements, particularly in that sphere of intergovernmental relations.
So those relationships that you've just described seem to have quite a positive framing. So is that the general tenor of negotiations of this type? Are they typically conducted in good faith, was a term that I think you used earlier? Are both kind of parties looking for a beneficial outcome, or are there areas where it is really actually quite antagonistic in this arena?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's really true. There are some very antagonistic interactions. I think one of them that I'm quite struck by is... or that I'm still trying to get my head around, actually, is Tennessee, is one of the states that I looked at in my dissertation research. And Tennessee becomes a state towards the end of George Washington's presidency. So the early Tennessee government is really interacting with the government of John Adams. Now, what do we think about Adams? Adams is, you know, a kind of uppity, very proud Bostonian who kind of credits himself as being a great intellectual. He's even, you know, tarred as being a monarchist by the Jeffersonians. Meanwhile, in Tennessee, you have these kind of people who are contemporaries, certainly, see as being these rough and ready frontiersmen who are out there in really difficult circumstances, essentially on the frontier. And the Adams administration and the government of Tennessee kind of come to blows over the boundary line between Indian country and white settlement the late 1790s. And I really felt in some of those letters that, wow, the governor of Tennessee really doesn't like Adams, and he really doesn't think that he's got good intentions. But I think these men are good enough at manipulation that they often use that as a cover for their sort of personal antagonisms.
Wow, really interesting. One last question, I guess, is I never thought I'd be so interested about the interplay of state dynamics, because not my area at all, but I was wondering about how do, say, someone in a federal government having an idea about lighthouses end up getting passed when you're having to have state interaction? So what is that actual mechanism like? Is it a, you know, government by letters, or is there a formal process that they're working out in this period that they're trying to say, well, if you want a law, this is what you do. These are the steps that are going on. Or is it still not formalised yet?
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things, one of the sort of comments I frequently make about intergovernmental relations in this period is that there isn't a formal institutional infrastructure. What a mouthful. So in the 20th century, obviously, there is, you know, the White House Office of Intergovernmental Affairs. There are all of these other kind of official task forces and things that really manage relationships between the state and federal governments. And I think one of the reasons I feel intergovernmental relations have been overlooked in this period is there isn't that formal institutional infrastructure. That said, how do states influence the process of making a law? Well, they feel that they have quite a lot of influence over the Senate. So obviously, in this period, senators are not elected by the people. They are appointed or chosen by the state legislature. And states often try to, quote unquote, instruct their senators and say, we elected you, you have to do what we say, you have to vote in the way that we tell you to vote. So they try to influence outcomes in that way, and by appealing to congressmen as well. And then in terms of the process, I think there becomes sort of a, maybe not a formal process, but an informal process by which states are kind of expected to kind of respond to what the federal government does. They get in touch with the federal government and say, look, here's this act that we've passed in response to your act. What do you think about it? And the federal government comes back and says, either you're going to have to change your law or we're going to have to change our law because they're in conflict with each other. And that sort of becomes a way of doing things, but it isn't really sort of an institution in the same way that like the Department of the Treasury is, or the, you know, the War Office is.
Yeah, thank you. Some really good answers there. So I just kind of want to ask you, just to end, so you get the final word. What do you want people to take away from this and from your reading of this period? Both people who are involved in this world and this kind of arena of scholarship and people that aren't, you know, what's the take home there?
What's the big takeaway? So I think for people who are really interested in the history of the state, I do want to be pushing back a little bit on the idea that the federal government was powerful, was super, super powerful, at least in this period, partly because I want them to say, okay, what was the Constitution designed to do? At heart, well, it was designed to give the federal government greater power in foreign affairs and over the military and in the territories, sure. But it was also designed to give the federal government greater power within the states, to allow federal laws to go into effect, whether or not the state government actually consented directly to that. But in fact, what we're seeing is the states really did have to consent in order for federal laws to go into effect. So that's and that has an effect on, I think, how we should understand, to get to a kind of broader point, sovereignty. So I mentioned at the very beginning this idea that the United States has a divided sovereignty. And what I'm kind of seeing here, and it's in the title of my paper, is the fact that obviously their sovereignty, the sovereignty of the state level and the sovereignty of the federal level, were kind of mutually dependent on one another. So the states needed the protection of the federal government. They sometimes needed money from the federal government to make sure that they could do what they wanted to do. The federal government had to respect their sort of legislative capabilities. But so too did the states have to respect what the federal government wanted to do, consent to it, in order to allow for the sovereignty of the federal government, for it to be able to enforce its laws within the United States. So those are my big takeaways.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I think we'll end there. So thank you very much, Grace, and thank you very much, Jazz, for joining in.
Thank you very much.
And thank you for having me.
Perfect. And that was Grace Mallon and Jasmine Bath. Thanks for listening, and be on the lookout for the next episode.